We band together into groups, we human beings, for many solid reasons. Through states, schools, congregations, corporations, organizations, families, well, we can accomplish things together that we could never do alone. Whether we want to build a suspension bridge or prepare children for adulthood, we band together to pool our resources. We learn from the exchange of ideas. We benefit from the ways that others' caution checks our impetuousness. And if we're the ones dragging, we benefit from the inspiration of others who may pull us forward. In a state of war against other humans or nature, we form organizations for safety, like armies and fire brigades. And then in more peaceful times, we come together in cooperatives and organizations for reform. Our lives are overlapping circles of membership in all these institutions. On the other hand, institutions have a bad reputation. As either Groucho Marx or Gloria Steinem said, or maybe Steinem was quoting Groucho, marriage is a fine institution. I just don't want to live in an institution. Now, as Caitlin pointed out to me when I was talking about how comically negative the word is, there is one deeply respectful use of the word institution. When we say that someone is an institution, we're saying they're honored and indispensable. But alongside that respectful significance, there float the specters of the walls of an asylum, the bars of a prison. Yes, we can institutionalize a great idea. That's good. Or we can institutionalize an uppity person. That's bad. Altogether, as a country and as a religious tradition, we lean toward anti-institutionalism. Maybe it's for the same reason. Our country among countries is quite young, and so is Unitarian Universalism among traditions. And anti-institutionalism is often a wave of youth. James Luther Adams, the Unitarian theologian who shared his five smooth stones, his guiding principles for liberal religion, of which we are speaking of the fourth today, he was perfectly familiar with anti-institutionalism. But at the time he wrote these words, his country had yet to go through the experiences that, of all the events of his lifetime, which more or less spanned the 20th century, probably caused the greatest cynicism about our institutions. The Vietnam War would begin with a lie. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. And over 10 years, it would entangle numerous countries and end over a million largely young lives as it dragged the reputations of the best and the brightest, military intelligence and the U.S. government through the mud. Also at that time, COINTELPRO, the FBI's massive program of infiltrating local political organizations and funding provocateurs, caused people to mistrust not only the government, but the organizations that they had joined to reform government and do other good work. And then, of course, for us U.S. Americans, came Watergate and the revelations of the depth of our institutions' corruption. Those who do not like institutions, or who want to argue that we would be better off without them, can give many reasons. They are rigid. They trap us in commitments that we would rather not make, that somebody in the institution wants to keep. They are slow and resistant to change, as all parties must agree before they can move. Institutions are prone either to lockstep thinking or else so much internal dissension that they can't get anything done. They diffuse responsibility so that no one need feel responsible for the problems that the institution causes. These are all genuine drawbacks. On the other hand, it seems to me that for each of them, there's a parallel drawback of operating without outside an institution. That's just assuming for the sake of argument that Adams is wrong and we can operate outside of institutions, that we can be pure individuals. For example, the opposite of an institution's rigidity is a freewheeling individual's lack of structure, lack of accountability. An individual refrains from being trapped by commitments only if he, she, isn't making any. And what kind of life of conscience would that be? A life with no commitments. It's true that individuals are more nimble and quick than institutions, can make decisions and act more quickly, but they can also rush into changes that wiser heads might counsel against. An individual who consults no one is free from lockstep thinking, but loses the benefits of the give and take of opinion. An individual claims sole responsibility for what they do, but usually gets far less done than we can accomplish when we work together. I think there's another reason, in addition to all of these, that we are uncomfortable with institutions. And that is that we are uncomfortable acknowledging the importance of power. We would prefer to think that we relate to each other as equals, that there are no power dynamics between us, that we're individuals independent of the machinations of power. But Adams denied and asserted that a faith of the free must deny the immaculate conception of virtue. In strong words that we shared, he declared that for something to exist effectively, for it to make a difference in our lives, it must use the power of organization and the organization of power. Even if we could exist as free-floating individuals, it would be wrong to do so. Anyway, we can't. Adams' contemporary, Jean-Paul Sartre, explored this problem in a controversial play called Dirty Hands. In it, a young man is called upon to put his revolutionary principles into action by assassinating a leader who has betrayed the movement. Now, Sartre made his revolutionary a leftist, a left-winger like himself, with the result that people on the left wing hated the play, and the right wing hailed it. But one could just as easily reverse the polls and present the same problem, the real dilemma with which Sartre confronts us all, the problem, that is, that confronts us, each one of us, whether we acknowledge it or realize it or not. And that is that we cannot act in this world and remain pure and unsullied. We cannot remain pure. Nor can we remain pure by refusing to act. Since refusing to act, we all know, is an action itself. Silence is complicity. A refusal to act is support for whoever is in power. No, we must take our place in the actions or thoughtful restraint of our communities and thus become sullied by them. In the play, the young man wants justice done, and he believes that that justice means the death of the leader, the former revolutionary now turned against the revolution. But the young man doesn't want to carry out the act himself, and he's challenged by his would-be victim, who speaks in these words, "You cling so tightly to your purity, my lad. How terrified you are of sullying your hands. Well, go ahead then, stay pure. What good will it do, and why even bother coming here among us? Purity is a concept of fakirs and friars. But you, the intellectuals, the bourgeois anarchists, you invoke purity as your rationalization for doing nothing. Do nothing. Don't move. Wrap your arms tight around your body. Put on your gloves. As for myself, my hands are dirty. I have plunged my arms up to the elbow in excrement and blood. And what else should one do? Do you suppose that it is possible to govern innocently? The character who speaks these harsh words, challenging the reluctant assassin, challenges as well all of us who, while never asked to do anything as drastic as kill another person, are still required to dirty our hands. Maybe we don't dirty them with blood and excrement, but certainly we must with the oily machinery of power and its compromises. We are, after all, citizens of a democracy and hold power one over another, whether we choose to use it or not. As Lin-Manuel Miranda, the composer of Hamilton, has Aaron Burr remind us, the art of the compromise, hold your nose, close your eyes. We want our leaders to save the day, but we don't get a say in what they trade away. We dream of a brand new start. But we dream in the dark for the most part. Unless we ourselves are willing to be in the room where it happens and engage with open eyes and dirty hands in the bargaining and business of making a change. Now, fed up with the institutions we've got, we might burn them down and start over. We've all been tempted at one time or another with one institution or another. But here's what happens. The ones we build in their place are likely to have many of the same drawbacks as the ones upon whose ashes they were built. Because many of these problems are built into working in groups. They are the problem of compromise, of not all being in agreement, of not all being in the same place, of not being able to see the future, and of the rigidity and slowness that balances out the nimbleness and hot-headedness of individuals. Well, okay then, if institutions exist, we might walk away from them. People do that too. Look at how many people don't even vote, much less serve in government, serve in the army, work in their community. But we never really break away from these institutions. As Adam says, virtue is always a matter of relationship. We are in relationship. We are in overlapping institutions no matter what. Much of the harm done in this world is done via institutions, via people who get together and do all sorts of damage that they probably couldn't do individually. It's true. So I wonder, could we perhaps counter this harm with radical institutionalism? Let's put that on a t-shirt. For example, something much on my mind today because of what's coming up after the service, the perniciousness of white supremacy has shaped and imbues many institutions in this country. Some would say all of them. From police departments, to children's textbooks, to housing, and on and on. Might we, who want to end it, not create an institution that will help us be powerful enough to eradicate it, such as the group we launched today? Join me in room 6 at 12:30. And yes, that institution will have its problems as well. Whether it's a group of 4 people or an organization of 1 million, it will have its problems as well, including perhaps ongoing traces of white supremacy. But what are we to do? We, who always have dirty hands. Well, what do we do as individuals? We use our conscience, as Caitlin reminded us, this is our fifth principle, the right of conscience, as we use the democratic process to change our ways, to operate our institutions. Let us reform our institutions, challenging them from within and without, as we challenge ourselves, as we listen to the call of conscience. Let's not stop that just because we're inside an organization. Let us hold them to high standards of virtue, as frustrating as that can be, as difficult as it can be. Here we are, within institutions, with our consciences. They need not fall silent. Let us seek to hold our institutions to high standards of virtue, but not purity, never purity. Because purity is a mythical creature. It's a mythical creature. And as we pursue it into the wilderness, we leave our nobler goals, which include justice and compassion and freedom, to crumble from disrepair behind us.